This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. For those not familiar, that is an eastern spadefoot toad. Spadefoot toads don't necessarily look like much, at least not to me. They're small, round, pale brownish-greenish. Basically, they're toads. But Ian Ives has a different perspective. He says these nondescript amphibians are impossible not to love once you get to know them. Maybe that's my problem. I haven't met one in person yet. Ives is the director of Mass Audubon's Mid and Upper Cape wildlife sanctuaries, including the beautiful Long Pond Wildlife Sanctuary overlooking Barnstable Harbor. He currently leads the Spadefoot Toad and Vernal Pool Restoration Project, taking place at two of the Cape's wildlife sanctuaries, Long Pond Pasture and also the Ashumet Holly Reserve here in Falmouth. And if there's one thing that Ives is even more passionate about than spadefoot toads, it's getting citizens and especially students involved in and excited about conserving rare species and habitats. So we've invited Ian here today to make his case for the spadefoot toad and to share with us some of Mass Audubon's research and education projects on Cape Cod. Ian Ives, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So describe the spadefoot toad and where does that name come from?
Spadefoot toad comes from the little spade. It's like a little keratin-like structure on its rear leg, on its foot. And it's actually that little spade that the toad uses to bury into the ground into its little fossorial chamber that it spends most of its life in.
So it spends most of the time underground and just comes out in the spring, right?
It comes out opportunistically after heavy rains and at nighttime to feed on ants and other things that it lives on. Really easy to overlook one of these toads.
So, and you were just saying a few minutes ago that when all of these toads, when all of the conditions are just right in a spring and a whole bunch of the spadefoot toads emerge at once, it's called a jubilee?
It's the jubilee year, yes. When the spadefoots succeed at metamorphing in mass, which they did this year, you can sometimes see hundreds of thousands of toads running around just along the edge of the pond that they metamorph from. And I had the opportunity this year at Sandy Neck Barrier Beach to see this, and it is truly amazing. It's a jubilee. It only happens every so often. All these circumstances, all of the pieces have to fall into place for this toad to be successful.
So what are some of those pieces that have to fall into place?
Lots of continuous rain over the period of several weeks or more from, say, April and May through till, say, mid-August. And so if there's steady rain, then the very shallow pools that these toads use to reproduce in will hold water long enough for the tadpoles to actually metamorph into toads. Most of the years, you don't get that. You get some heavy rain events, but, you know, given we're on the Cape in this really sandy environment, the water just sucks down into the ground. In other words, the water table isn't sustained at a high enough level long enough for these spadefoots to actually get out.
Okay, so what makes the spadefoot toad so lovable?
Oh, well, you have to spend some time with them. They're endearing once you get to know them. Well, they're really unique, and that's one of the things that, you know, as a biologist, you can enjoy about them. They're different than the average toad or frog that you find. They're the rarest frog, first of all, in the state, so you have to really look hard. And so generally, when you take a lot of time to look for something and then you get that eureka moment after spending hours and hours of looking, you know, it's that much more rewarding.
It's the excitement of discovery.
It's the excitement of discovery. And there's just a lot of really interesting natural history features about the toad. But again, you've got to be a little crazy. You've got to be willing to go out at night in March during a rainstorm, for example. You got to be willing to take a lot of time in the wetlands with mosquitoes and other things. And really look hard for them.
Well, I used to live actually across the street from a vernal pond. I lived on a circle where in the middle of the circle was this essentially 15 or 20 foot drop down to a vernal pond at the bottom. And the woods next to our house was actually used by spotted salamanders, another, I guess, threatened or at least rare amphibian. And they would, same kind of thing, cold, rainy night in March usually, you'd see the whole troop of them coming out and across the street and down to the pond. And it was amazing. The whole neighborhood really would kind of come together to come out and watch them and make sure the road was closed and that they were going to be okay that year.
Right. Yeah, they sort of galvanized around that really unique situation of seeing all this life appear at once. Yeah. It's amazing. A lot of these vernal pools that you're talking about have many different types of we call them obligate species that rely on vernal pools for their existence. But the spadefoots actually like the pools where no one else is. They like the ones that are the shallowest, have the least amount of competition and predators in them. And that also sort of is the reason why it's so unusual for the spadefoots to actually succeed in reproducing. It's because these pools are so ephemeral. They're just, you know, holding water for a very short period of time. So they're different than the average vernal pool that you'd find.
I'm talking with Ian Ives of Mass Audubon about the spadefoot toad and other wetland restoration and conservation projects going on at Audubon properties. If you have ever encountered a spadefoot toad, call us and let you know what you thought of it, what lengths you'd go to ensure their survival. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. You can also send Living Lab Radio a tweet or comment on our Facebook page. Now, the vernal ponds you were talking about, these very shallow vernal pools, I guess some of the most populated ones for spadefoot toads on the Cape are out on Sandy Neck Beach.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but they're fresh water, right? Even though they're
That's right
there on the beach.
Yeah. So there's a little lens, a very shallow lens of fresh water that sits above the seawater on places like Sandy Neck Barrier Beach or other barrier beaches on the Cape. Another big spot for the spadefoot is out in the province lands where the same environment exists. Lots of rolling dunes with swales, and it's in these swales, which in most cases are natural cranberry bogs, you find this always fluctuating water table coming up and down. So sometimes it's visible, sometimes it's below the sand. That's the habitat, on the Cape at least, that they prefer, and those are the two habitats where the species has their stronghold.
So, but you said the adults, actually, the pools are basically just for reproduction, where the tadpoles are growing and metamorphing into the adult toads. And once you've got the adults, they spend most of their life underground. So
are they
there under the sand on the beaches, or how far are they going, and what kind of habitat are they looking for as adults?
That's the question. And, you know, not that much is known about the spadefoot toad, relatively speaking, right? So, you know, there's a lot of research being done out on the province lands. To learn about their habitat requirements, their range, what they do when they're not reproducing in the pools. And it seems as though the spadefoot spends time, you know, maybe 1,000 or so meters away from the breeding pool. Just, you know, that's their range. But they spend most of their time relatively close to the breeding pool underground. And they will dig down using their little spade again, right? And they'll land, you know, themselves maybe a foot to 2 feet or more under the sand, where they can create themselves a little chamber. They excrete some fluids that allow them to live safely in a little subterranean chamber. And in doing so, they prevent desiccation. They prevent drying up. And so they can stay down there for long periods of time. They can stay down there for, you know, weeks or months on end in the wintertime, only coming up after, you know, a thaw and rain. And in the summertime, they'll spend most of the day down there, and they'll come up at night to feed.
So a foot or two deep, that's really amazing.
Or more, yeah.
For a really small toad that's only a couple
They're
of inches
diggers.
Long. They must be.
Yes.
So why does the spadefoot toad need conservation? What actually threatens it?
Well, it's because they're such specialists. You know, we've heard about all sorts of specialists on the Cape that require our help. Something like the piping plover comes to mind. These are animals that can't adapt to rapidly changing environment. They need, you know, really specific habitat in order to survive, and the spadefoot falls into that category. So, you know, they were all around New England, especially the southern parts, many years ago, but their range is slowly being restricted.
Do we know that, or is that what we suspect?
Historically, right now the spadefoot toad in Massachusetts is at the very northern extent of its range. It's unlikely that the spadefoot was much further north in New England, but southern New England certainly. And all the way down, you know, the species runs all the way down into Florida and west into Texas. So it's got a large range. And in most of its range, it's not considered rare. But here in Massachusetts, because we're way up at the northern extent of it, it is considered rare. And so what's happening is, you know, all these different pressures are being exerted on this species that can't adapt rapidly. And so, you know, it ends up being that you find little pockets. In some cases, these pockets of spadefoot toad populations are sinks, we call them, whereby there may be some toads and they may be reproducing every so often, but not enough to maintain a viable population. So what we're really looking to do with the project here is to slowly augment these declining populations and try to bring them back to a certain level of stability in the state.
Being at the very northern end of its range, is this a species that might actually benefit from climate change?
Yeah, it's a possibility. That's another one of the unknowns.
So it could actually perhaps move into, or at least in this area, benefit. We might see
it, yeah,
you know, contracting in the south, but perhaps moving more into our area.
It could, yeah.
So if that were to happen, do we have the habitat to support it currently?
Well, no. I mean, right now on Cape Cod, again, these two stronghold populations are out on the province lands and then along Sandy Neck and other smaller pockets of this sort of glacial outwash, really sandy type habitat. So it's about trying to find other suitable habitats that we could restore to help the population.
So talk a little bit about that. What are some of the measures that you're taking to try to conserve or actually bolster spadefoot toad populations?
Well, this project is all about restoration, augmentation of these of this declining population, trying to bring awareness to not just spadefoot toads, but to all sorts of these specialist species we're talking about that need our help. And you know, a lot of this work is really novel work. This is not mainstream conservation in many cases, because it's more than just protecting property and, you know, preserving spaces for wildlife, but it's actually managing these species. So
you're actually really doing almost environmental engineering,
them.
Right? You're talk a little about the process. I mean, you're creating new vernal pools for these toads to perhaps use, right?
So the foundation of the project is that we're trying again to expand the population of spadefoots on the Cape. So what we're doing is locating a vernal pool, a prospective vernal pool locations that could be restored or even just created.
I would say, so restored, you're...
When I say restored, I mean literally finding degraded, non-functioning wetlands that have been filled or drained perhaps back in the early 1800s for farming, ditches that were put in to divert water across the Cape. Resulted in draining of many of these really small vernal pools that we've been talking about. So we can identify spots that could benefit from restoration, and then we would design the wetlands specifically for the spadefoot toad to meet their specific needs, trying to replicate what they have out on Sandy Neck, for example, or out on the province lands as best we can. And we've learned a lot about what those are from doing some studies. And so, this is what the meat of the project is restoring habitat and then actively managing the species and educating the public about the benefits of doing so.
Now, the some of the pools, as I understand it, are actually concrete. So it's not just that you're digging out little holes in the ground or putting sand in there. I mean, it's not necessarily a completely natural wetland that you're creating for them.
Well, in our case, we are creating natural wetlands. Yeah, we're using a liner in some cases. The liner would be a plastic-like fish-safe liner that we would lay down at the bottom of a dugout basin. We would do this when we were creating a wetland in an upland, in an area where there isn't nearby groundwater. That's one technique that you can use to create wetlands. Another technique is to find, you know, these degraded wetlands that I was referring to and just dig down into the groundwater and actually, you know, restore the wetlands. You can build these surface water wetlands, you can build groundwater wetlands, and then you can build liner wetlands. And the liner wetlands are the ones that are give you the most flexibility, because you could put liner wetlands in schools. You could put liner, not in schools, but on the properties of schools. You could use liner wetlands in areas where there is no existing groundwater.
So then how do you get toads to those? I mean, this isn't just if you build it, they will come. You've got to actually put some toads there.
Right. So the process is we go to Sandy Neck Barrier Beach, in the case of this project, and we find eggs or newly hatched tadpoles of the spadefoot toad, and we head start them. We bring them into schools. We have about 10 schools that are participating in this project across the region, and they get this hands-on experience of raising this endangered species and getting it to the point of metamorphosis, at which point we then take them in large numbers to these newly created wetlands and release them. And this is called a translocation. And in order to do this with a species, you need permission from the state. You need permission from the Natural Heritage Endangered Species Program. They give us permission to go ahead and do this. It's actually only the third vertebrate that has been permitted by the state to be moved from one location in the state to the other. And the only other two are the Plymouth red-belly turtle and the beaver. So it's not common to be able to do this. And this is what I'm talking about when I say that this is novel, hands-on, sort of pioneering work. This isn't something that's typical. But we think that with the techniques that we have, the understanding of the species, that we can do this successfully.
My guest is Ian Ives, director of Mass Audubon's Mid and Upper Cape Wildlife Sanctuaries, and we're talking this hour about spadefoot toads and more broadly about the research and conservation work going on at Audubon properties around Cape Cod. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our phone number. That's 866-999-4626. You can also email us, livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. or connect with Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. So, Ian, before the break, you were talking about this translocation process. You build new vernal pools, and then you actually head start. And I love that term. Kind of, you know, we all think of head start being preschools, but head start these toads actually in schools with students taking care of them, and then take the new young toads to these pools. Do they stay there?
That's a good question. We hope so. The goal is to, in head starting, we hope that we will provide a little extra fitness, we call it fitness, to the species. In other words, by giving them this head start, they are a little heavier. When we release them, they may just be better off in terms of being able to protect themselves from predators, just being stronger and more fit. And so we think that that's a big plus in helping these toads actually survive once they're released into the new ponds, because we could simply just take them as eggs or newly hatched tadpoles and move them over to the new ponds. We feel like, given the last 3 years of doing this, the actual head starting makes a big difference for them. Gives them a better likelihood of surviving.
Have you actually studied, compared,
yes,
just putting eggs in versus,
yes,
doing
have
the head starting,
yep,
and that
we
it
have
bears out?
The way that we can learn as to whether or not we're getting a nice rate of return on all this effort of head starting is by setting up some traps. We call them pitfall traps, and we put them around the newly created wetlands. And we have staff that are out monitoring these pitfall traps, and they can detect what's falling into these traps. In other words, what things are coming to and from the wetlands on a regular basis. So many of the toads that we have released, we have seen in these traps, which tells us that, you know, they're doing well. But it's going to take another 3 or 4 years of releasing thousands of toads per year and then monitoring the success to determine whether we can call at least that portion of the project successful. In other words, the augmentation of the spadefoot. Are we actually helping promote spread of the species? That answer is still yet to be determined.
So, I mean, you're obviously the end goal would be that you don't have to keep dumping in toads every year, that you would actually then establish a reproducing population around these
That's
new
right.
pools.
That we'd give them that jump start that they would need to be self-sufficient.
Yeah. And I guess with amphibians, you probably don't. I know with like the whooping crane projects where they actually rear them in a wetland and have actually trained them to follow planes down to other new wetlands. They go through these very elaborate steps to make sure that those cranes don't get too acclimated to humans and to try to teach them natural survival techniques. I guess you don't have any of that kind of issue with the toads. They're fine with being reared in a classroom and then dumped into a pond.
Yeah, not so much. These are just tadpoles. You know, there's not a lot of physical contact going on with them. They're just eating machines. When they're in that tadpole stage, they're growing rapidly, eating very quickly, growing very quickly, and then being released. And it's very simple to do, which is why we're able to involve many different age groups with the project. This head starting piece is very fun for kids from kindergarten all the way through till high school. And we can incorporate different projects or studies within the head starting protocol depending on the age of the kids. So, for example, there's some biology, AP biology students at Falmouth High School that are involved with this project, and they're doing more elaborate measurements and protocols with regard to the head starting than, say, a kindergarten group would. But we're finding that the value of the head starting for these kids is tremendous because they're getting an opportunity to see real-life science take place. It's not just a didactic exercise for them, but something that they, you know, it's a very tangible experience for them. And knowing that they're working with scientists in a species that is in literally their backyard is empowering to them. And so it's very valuable.
So they're not just free labor to actually get the rearing of the toads done. There's a benefit to them as well from these projects.
It's a benefit. And this is really, I think, the biggest, most important component of this whole project is this outreach and engagement with the public and getting a higher level of appreciation and respect for the environment. And you can only do that through direct observation. And this is really a big part of what we're doing at Long Pasture, the sanctuary, and across all the Mass Audubon sanctuaries, using the work that we do, the conservation science work, to engage the public.
So, I mean, is the spadefoot toad, you know, a really key species in the ecosystem that needs to be preserved for the ecosystem's health, or is this really just a charismatic and easy to work with species that can enable you to do this kind of outreach work that you're talking about?
A little bit of both, absolutely. It is in some regards a mascot. The spadefoot toad is an example of the work that we do, and so it's really, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's more about the work that we're doing revolving around the outreach than it is specifically about saving the spadefoot toad in Massachusetts.
And you also, in addition to schools, you have a number of other partners on this project, a combination of government agencies, non-government environmental groups. Is that collaborative aspect to the project kind of an extra bonus, something you've chosen to do, or do you feel like that's really
a
backbone of the project and necessary to its success?
It's absolutely necessary. And we've seen this time and time again, that partnering with different organizations and agencies is critical to making the project work. We have a small budget at Long Pasture that we can rely on for work like this. We have a limited amount of expertise. We're doing many things, so we need all the help we can get. So, yes, we've got agencies such as Fish and Wildlife. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Partners Program has supported the project through funding and through technical expertise. We have a partner named Brian Windmiller who works with me, is co-manager of the project, who gives all sorts of scientific input, added capacity in terms of the work in the field and the design of the project. We've gotten funding through the USDA. The local NRCS office has supported the project, especially the wetland creation aspect. And then the Center for Wetland and Stream Restoration out of Kentucky has been our wetland guru. They've been the outfit that's helped support the actual wetland restoration and creation techniques.
So in terms of creating these wetlands, I mean, you said this is not necessarily your typical way of going about species conservation. You are picking spots to modify, essentially engineer the environment to create perhaps new wetlands, or at least wetlands that haven't been there for going on 200 years. Do you ever encounter some controversy and some pushback saying, well, we shouldn't be engineering the environment in this way?
Well, sure. Again, because this is new, groundbreaking, pioneering type work, it's not traditional. I mean, in some respects, the approach, accepted approach to wildlife management would be to protect properties, to manage properties by protecting them. Whereas what we're doing here is promoting more hands-on active management, whereby we may be manipulating the environment a little bit. We may be, directly working with these species, such as the translocation aspect here in this case. So, we feel like there's so much to gain from this hands-on, interactive style of this project that it's well worth the effort. But you're right, it's something that in some cases takes a little bit of prodding.
Well, I mean, I think we have a fairly checkered, at best, track record of environmental engineering, whether that's, large engineering projects like dams or levees or that kind of thing, or introducing species for biological control. A lot of these efforts have, in the long run, backfired, and we've figured out that we didn't know enough to actually be playing with the environment in those ways.
Yes.
Do you ever worry that 50 or 100 years down the road, we'll figure out that, oh, this actually wasn't the best course of action, and in some way we actually made the situation a little bit worse?
Well, in the case of the spadefoot, we know that this species has lived in this region for thousands of years. And in terms of, genetic manipulation, which is something that conservation biologists are really concerned about, there's no issues because, we're talking about moving the spadefoot just a few tens of miles from one location to another. So we're confident that there's not going to be any genetic issues. In terms of, moving species in a way that they wouldn't be accustomed to, the species, the way we're doing it isn't going to have any, detrimental impacts. And it's certainly not going to have any detrimental impacts on the host population because, again, we're taking a small number of tadpoles and eggs from a population that is very well established. And 90%, if not more, 99% probably, of the tadpoles that we'd be taking wouldn't have survived to metamorphose anyways.
So you said we know they've been in this region for thousands of years. How do we know that?
From geological records, from just lots of science that's gone into studying the species over the years.
Do you find fossil toads in the area, or what is it that's actually...
Well, it's just knowing the range expansion of the species over the years, documentation of the species over the years. It's expanded.
So in terms of the kind of bigger picture within Audubon sanctuaries, you know, you said this is not the typical thing that's going on in general in terms of conservation biology. Audubon has 10 properties on Cape Cod, right? And some of those are open to the public, some are not. Are most of them involved in this kind of environmental engineering, or are most of them in the more traditional sort of we've acquired a property and we're just going to let it sit there and not be developed further?
Well, Mass Audubon has developed ecological monitoring sort of protocols that we use to manage our properties. And these protocols involve assessments of the properties, whereby we go through each of the habitats within the properties and identify the needs. And, you know, the sanctuary directors of each of the sanctuaries, in conjunction with our regional scientists, identify priority needs for the sanctuaries and property management needs. So depending on the property, there's all sorts of activities taking place. It could be targeting, pollinators. It could be targeting any number of wildlife that exists at the sanctuaries. So it's a comprehensive plan.
So how are the properties actually chosen or acquired? Is it mostly by chance?
Well, in some cases, opportunistic chance, yeah. Most of the properties Mass Audubon has received come through gifts. Many of them come with endowments, others don't. It just so happened at Long Pasture back in the mid-90s, an individual had about 100 acres of land, and he also had an interest in providing an endowment for Mass Audubon to establish Long Pasture Wildlife Sanctuary. And so one of the things that Mass Audubon does in determining whether a potential land gift is appropriate or not to take in is just to look at all the different features, look at the location of the sanctuary. Is it directly abutting or contiguous with other protected properties in the area, therefore making its value that much more appealing? Looking at rare species on the habitat, many things that go into it.
So it's not just an automatic, yes, we'll take that and figure out what we can do with it. There's a lot of assessment that goes into it.
That's right. Because the management involved in maintaining and managing these habitats is pretty significant. It takes a lot of time.
So talk about some of the other activities that are going on, say, at Long Pasture, in addition to this spadefoot toad restoration project.
Well, when it comes to conservation projects and citizen science projects, we're always trying to find projects that are multifaceted, similar to the Spadefoot project, that have an education component, a conservation component, and a citizen science or volunteer component to them, because it opens up many more possibilities for success. It opens up many more possibilities for engagement. And so, you know, we've done projects with ospreys. We have a Cape Cod osprey project that the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary and Long Pasture work together on, whereby we're cataloging nest sites for ospreys across the Cape and learning about the productivity of these nests. In other words, how many chicks are fledging, how successful these nests are at fledging. And we've got many volunteers, 80 or more volunteers, that are helping with this project that's been very fun and successful over the years and growing. We've been doing a lot of horseshoe crab monitoring, spawning surveys across the Cape. We've been doing a lot of pollinator studies and pollinator projects. At Long Pasture, we have a butterfly mosaic trail that we built.
What is that?
Well, it's a trail that's designed to be an interpretive, self-guided trail for the public that meanders through some of our open fields. And along the trail, there are 10 different little plots, garden plots. And within these plots, we have identified native plant species that are host plants and nectaring sources for different butterfly species. And so through an interpretive guide, we talk about the different species that butterflies rely on and how you can plant these native species in your own garden. So that's a project that involves volunteers because we're doing a lot of butterfly monitoring and tending of the gardens. It's got an educational outreach piece to it, because we bring schools through, do a lot of education, curriculum-based education with schools. And, of course, it's got the conservation component as well by increasing biodiversity of pollinators in our fields. So it's another multifaceted project that we're doing.
And how many of the projects are happening at, say, just one wildlife sanctuary, and how many are really involving this whole network of sanctuaries that Mass Audubon has collectively?
Well, what's interesting about Mass Audubon is it has many different sanctuaries scattered around the state, and each sanctuary is very distinct in many ways ecologically. And so in some cases, there are a lot of overlap between the sanctuaries in terms of the species that utilize them. In other cases, there's some real specificity. So it really depends on what individual species you're talking about. The Osprey Project, for example, is something that many sanctuaries can be involved in, not just on the Cape, but, you know, Allen's Pond Wildlife Sanctuary on the South Shore. Many sanctuaries can be involved with that. Maybe something like piping plovers, you're likely going to have, you know, only coastal sanctuaries.
Of course, only where the beaches are.
Yeah.
And I'm talking with Ian Ives, director of Mass Audubon's Mid and Upper Cape Wildlife Sanctuaries. And we're talking about research and conservation initiatives on Cape Cod, especially the spadefoot toad. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free phone number. That's 866-999-4626. And Joel is on the line from Brewster. Joel, what's on your mind?
I have a certified pool that I got certified many years ago because it abutted another piece of property that was going to soon be bait for developer type people, and because it was where wood frog breeded, and they would chorus every spring. It was interesting. You walk the road from my house down to the road was a 300-year-old causeway that just circled right around the edge of this pond. Very often there'd be three mallards in there, a little love fight going on. It sounded so much like a wood frog, you couldn't tell which was which until you flushed the ducks out of there. But the wood frogs seem to have disappeared. And I'm curious how one goes about finding out what might have caused it. Now, there hasn't been any development around here. The pond still works pretty well, although the town is constantly trying to destroy it by draining the water table. And, of course, the level of that pond from its highest point to where it dries up in August is the level of a water table. You can't tell the DPW or the town anything about that.
Well, Joel, let's see if we can get an answer about these wood frogs here. It sounds like a beautiful little pool.
It's really hard to tell whether a species like a wood frog has actually disappeared or not. Take it from me, because I've spent a lot of time looking for these things over the years. And many factors go into, you know, life history of wood frogs. They move around a lot in the environment. It's possible that these guys have moved, you know, to nearby neighboring wetlands. It's possible that they just didn't have a particularly good year this year at that vernal pool. Maybe the water level was lower than it normally is. Maybe it was, you know, had a lot of predation. Any number of things could have taken place. It's really hard to tell unless you're there looking.
All right. Well, Joel, thanks for that call. Again, our toll-free number, if you have a question or comment, is 866-999-4626. You can also email us, livinglabradio@capeandislands.org, or connect with Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Now, the other thing Joel mentioned is this idea of a certified vernal pool. What does that mean? How do you get a pool certified? And what is the benefit of that?
Certification is something that needs to take place by the public. There are no hired professionals from agencies in the state of Massachusetts that are certifying vernal pools in the state. In order to certify a vernal pool, a landowner needs to go online or contact the Mass Fish and Wildlife Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program. They're the non-game program that oversees wetlands protection and oversees endangered species. And you can go through the process of documenting a given vernal pool. And what you need to do is prove that your vernal pool has the criteria necessary for certification. And once it's certified, then it becomes protected under the Wetlands Protection Act. And this is very important. And And it's because many of the species that rely on these vernal pools cannot use any other type of wetland. They need these very ephemeral, fishless environments to survive. They're called obligate species, and the wood frogs fall into that category. Wood frogs would be one of the obligate species you would need to be able to record in order to certify a vernal pool. And there's many vernal pools scattered around our landscape. These are vernal pools that were created from, in some cases, the last glaciation that came through, little pockmarks in the environment. They could be ditches that were dug from borrow pits from cranberry work that was taking place. It could be any number of certifiable vernal pools in our environment. And it's a great way for students to become involved in local conservation, to get out and actually certify these vernal pools. Yeah, because it's a pretty elaborate process.
Now, Mass Audubon actually predates the National Audubon Society and remains essentially an independent organization, correct?
I mean, that's right.
Why remain independent as opposed to joining the National Audubon?
Well, Mass Audubon was the first Audubon in the country and actually helped to create other regional Audubons, which may in this case now become or have become chapters of National Audubon. But Mass Audubon remains autonomous and focused strictly on Massachusetts, protecting the nature of Massachusetts. So whereas National Audubon has produced chapters all around the country, Mass Audubon and other state, you know, autonomous Audubons exist.
Now, Mass Audubon is really philosophically committed to making sure that positions on conservation issues like conserving the spadefoot toad or any of these other rare species have a scientific basis. And I wonder why the commitment to that, to play devil's advocate. That sounds like a great thing, but wouldn't it be equally valid to simply say, this is a value judgment. We think that we should have spadefoot toads, and so we're going to go forward. What is the added value of having a scientific foundation for that?
Well, I think the whole idea of scientific foundation is long-standing observations and accumulated data to back questions that you may have about, you know, whatever it is that you're studying. So, I mean, science is a slowly evolving process. The study of spadefoot toads has not played out. The study of lots of what we do hasn't played out. And there's many checks and balances in science that are necessary. I think this is what's really intriguing about local conservation is many of the steps that we take have not been proven. It doesn't mean they're not valuable and valid. And I think the most important role we can play is to, Mass Audubon can play, is to promote the work that we're doing so that others can see the process and understand the process. It's always more complicated. Science is more complicated than it may seem to be. There's many more facets of conservation work that you know, the general public may not easily understand without being directly involved. We see this time and time again. The complexities, the intricacies of conservation work are many. It's difficult work, but it's very rewarding work as well. And this is this is something that we really want to promote.
So how much of the science that you use, the research that you base your conservation on, how much of that comes from external, I guess, independent academic or government research entities, and how much of that actually comes from scientists employed by the Audubon?
It's a little bit of both, depending on the project. But this, again, gets back to the whole premise of science, is that you utilize many different means of information, many different venues or, you know, aspects of information to fuel your work. So in the case of the Spadefoot Project, we have a foundation of information that's been gathered by other researchers doing work in and around the Cape. And in Massachusetts, we rely on the state for a lot of information, foundational information, right? But then it takes long hours of field work, you know, learning about the individual species. There's so much information that isn't known that we've learned in the last 3 years. And we're adapting slowly to the project. Every year is an adaptive process of learning from our successes and learning from our mistakes.
I wonder if you ever see almost a conflict of interest between the science and the conservation. I mean, science can go out and tell us there are this many spadefoot toads and there used to be perhaps more. They used to be in different places. But then it's a value judgment to say, well, we should bring them back to that previous level, or we should take these actions and actually rebuild wetlands to make opportunities. And when you've got an organization that is kind of values driven like the Audubon is, but then saying it's based on science, how do those two fit together?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question. Again, I think it really has to do with getting to know the species, working with it directly, and then adapting as you go forward. And there's many examples of species that are really directly indebted to us. You can think of, again, the piping plover, even eastern bluebirds. You know, we are manipulating their environment for their benefit in many cases. And it's, you know, for many of these species, they're at the point, because they're so inflexible, because they're such specialists, that they require our help now in order to protect them and maintain the population.
It's sort of course, in many of the cases, that they are having that trouble because of our actions have limited their opportunities.
That's right.
And so, how much of your education and outreach is about just getting people familiar with the science, and how much of it is trying to perhaps instill this value of conservation and stewardship?
It's both. It really is. It's both. It's. I think from my personal perspective, it's the appreciation and respect for the environment that is most lacking these days, just because of the nature of our culture these days. And students have a lot less, children have a lot less opportunity to get out into the woods than they used to. They don't have the direct experience with a lot of the natural world around them. And so to provide that foundation of interest, to sort of open those doors of interest, is hugely powerful.
So again, do you think that teaching them the science makes that more powerful, or would it essentially be an equally valuable experience for them to simply meet the spadefoot toad and think, well, this is a cute little creature with a funny call? Is that enough, or is it really that they need to have the scientific underpinning as well to get the full appreciation?
I think personally they need the experience more. I do. I think the experience is what drives interest.
And
I
so
think
really
the science will be there. I mean, it's part of the curriculum. But for them to have the enthusiasm that I do in something like this, they need to get out and actually see it for themselves. That's where the light goes off. That's the eureka moment, you know, seeing that jubilee of toads for the first time, or finding, you know, a wood frog for the first time. Those are the kind of experiences that you know, lead to a lifetime of curiosity and science.
You've been doing this for a few years and working with the schools. Has it, as some of these new curriculum requirements have come into place in schools, has it become more difficult to get teachers to dedicate the time to these kinds of projects? Or are you finding ways to really work this into those requirements?
That's a great question. Well, this is what we're faced with all the time, is when we show teachers Mass Audubon's curriculum-based education, they're intrigued. And in the case of Long Pasture, we're relatively new as a sanctuary, so in many cases we like to provide schools with a pilot project that introduces them to our work. It's very curriculum-based, lesson-oriented work. And we find that there's never a resistance to the work. It's just about the logistics. It's about finding the funding, finding a way for the teachers to be able to complete their tasks, their curriculum standards, and get the enrichment and value of what we're offering. So we know that we can provide them with the curriculum-based, standards-based education through these programs. So they don't have to sacrifice that in order to achieve what they need to achieve as teachers.
It just takes a little bit of creativity.
It takes creativity and it takes funding. Certainly it takes funding. So we're very flexible in terms of how we go about finding funding. We can get funding through grants and through private individuals, through PTAs, through different funds that towns have established for their public schools. There's many different ways that we can do this.
Is there ever an art component when you're out working with these students? Because, you know, that's become an increasingly, a trendy, more popular thing, is to try to merge the science and the art. Because, again, that gets to that point that you were speaking about really engaging children at almost an emotional level, as opposed to just the science of the species.
It gets back to the creativity aspect. Yeah, absolutely. We have some programs that involve art and ecology, and they seem to be very, very rewarding for the students because, they're utilizing their powers of observation and, formulating different ideas. Some of them can be artistic. Others can be scientific.
Now, how did you first meet a spadefoot toad?
Well, the reason this project got started is I was out at the Shumet-Hawley Wildlife Sanctuary and learned about a spadefoot toad that was documented there. And I went to the location where it was documented. It was in a old pump well that was used to irrigate fields back in the 1800s. And this toad apparently had been walking along the landscape and just dropped into this pitfall trap, basically. And lo and behold, I went to the site, and I didn't find a spadefoot toad, but I found many other things that were trapped in this pitfall trap. And then decided that this was a worthwhile project to engage in, because we knew at that point that the spadefoot was at Ashumet Holly, and that it would probably benefit from augmenting the population.
And did you immediately, when you heard about this or saw the toad there, immediately know, oh, well, this is a rare species and this is a real opportunity? Or did it take a little bit of digging to what is this animal and what's it doing here?
Yeah, no, we knew. We knew what it was. We knew that it was rare. We knew that it would benefit from some conservation. It wasn't until I got to Sandy Neck Barrier Beach, where there's many opportunities to see spadefoots, if you're looking for them, that I actually found one in real life. And that was fun. It was one of those eureka moments.
We have a number of photos on our website for folks who want to get to know a spadefoot toad, because now is not really the season if you were to go out to Sandy Neck.
No,
but early spring, can people just get out there and see these for themselves?
Yeah, we certainly can hear them. Depending on what sort of gear you have, you could see them. But what I'd recommend is driving out to Sandy Neck Barrier Beach, the main road from the gatehouse out to the beach. Do so on a wet night in April or May, a real wet night.
That sounds so appealing, doesn't
it? I know. I'm telling you, you got to be a little crazy. A real wet night, a heavy rainstorm. And just roll down your windows in your car and you'll be able to hear them chorusing. The males will be chorusing in the water in the vernal pools, drawing attention to themselves, hoping to attract the females, which will come down, and then they'll be breeding in the wetlands, laying eggs.
So is that call, do we know what the purpose of it is? Is it an attraction, mating call?
Oh, yeah. It's meant to attract females. Yeah, many males congregating, we call it, and chorusing among themselves. One will trigger an outburst from another, and before you know it, you have this cacophony of calls similar to what we were hearing.
Right, that little clip we played, and then also, as Joel was mentioning, with the wood frogs in his vernal pool chorusing. And
yeah.
Of course, we get the spring peepers, so you've got different choruses depending on the pond that's near you.
That's right, in a succession of choruses over the course of the season.
Well, Ian Ives, director of Mass Audubon's Mid and Upper Cape Wildlife Sanctuaries and currently heading up the Spadefoot Toad and Wetland Restoration Project going on at Mass Audubon's Long Pasture and Ashumet Holly Reserves here on Cape Cod. Ian Ives, thank you for introducing us to the Spadefoot Toad. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
It was a great opportunity to talk about local conservation. Thank you.
And you can find a map of Mass Audubon's 10 properties on Cape Cod, take in a photo tour of the Ashumet Holly Wildlife Sanctuary, and of course also see and hear the spadefoot toad all on our website, capeandislands.org. Click on Living Lab in the program menu to find all of those extras. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio anytime on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.